In the conclusion to your book, Hidden Genius, you ask yourself a question that I ask all my guests. It's a question about success. And you share a story how asking yourself that question changed the trajectory of your life. Can you share that story?
So I was on the subway going home from my work at Fortune Magazine. And I was sitting on the subway and I read this commencement speech by Anna Quinlan. And she says, if your success looks good to the world but doesn't feel good in your heart, then it is not success at all. I don't know, it just like really like struck me because I was like, oh, wait a second. How do I measure success and how do I define success? And to me, at the time, for a long time, it was like steady job, health insurance, material possessions, how much money you make. Like those were markers of success. And, you know, after I read this, I had been kind of thinking like, do I want to leave my job to go work on the profile full time? All those markers would kind of be gone. Like people wouldn't see me working at Fortune magazine, all this stuff. Like the validation wouldn't be there. Maybe the money wouldn't be there at first. What is success? And then I realized like to me, success is just like feeling fulfilled. When I read that, I started thinking more and I was just like, wow, well, what do all these different people, like how do they define success? For me, it's like, do I feel like the things that I'm working on, I'm excited about and I feel expansive? That's success to me, like a life really well lived.
Welcome to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest topic of all, money. How to make it, save it, keep it. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question, what it means to live a rich life beyond money. My guests share their practices, principles, and evergreen wisdom. I'm your host, Bogumil Baranowski, author, TEDx speaker, and investment advisor to wealth creators with patient capital and an infinite investment horizon. I work with families and individuals who aspire to grow wealth over a lifetime and generations through disciplined, thoughtful investments in durable, quality businesses while giving money meaning. Join me on this quest to unearth and share the wisdom of the ages. I'll keep it short. If you want to get in touch with me, head over to my website, Bogumil Baranowski, where I read your emails and reply to all, and I even offer Zoom calls to you, my listeners. If you want to follow my essays, go to Substack. If you're curious about my last book, search for Crisis Investing. If you want to keep up with Talking Billions, subscribe, follow, and please share it around. It means the world to me. There's no marketing budget behind the podcast. There's no ad revenue. It's all word of mouth and genuine curiosity, yours, mine, and that of our guests. On to the show. Just a quick reminder, I'm the host of the show, but I also work for a registered investment advisor. This episode is for informational purposes only and is not investment advice. My views are personal and not those of the firm. Any securities mentioned are for illustrative purposes and are not recommendations. Investing involves risks. Please consult a financial advisor. Full disclosure can be found in the notes and at the end of the episode. My guest today is the author of Hidden Genius, The Secret Ways of Thinking That Power the World's Most Successful People, Paulina Marinova Pompliano. She's the founder of The Profile, a media organization that studies successful people and companies. Previously, she spent 5 years at Fortune, where she covered technology and venture capital. As the author and editor of Termsheet, Fortune's industry-leading deal-making newsletter, Paulina interviewed the industry's most influential dealmakers, including Melinda Gates, Steve Schwarzman, Richard Branson, and more. In today's episode, we embark on a captivating journey through the bustling corridors of New York City subway, where inspiration often strikes unexpectedly. From the underground musings, we delve into the transformative power of personal narratives, discovering profound insights and relatable wisdom from the experiences of others. My guest, Paulina, shares invaluable lessons gleaned from the paths of the most successful individuals. Amidst tales of triumph, we explore the notion that success is not always a linear journey, Rather, it often manifests in the midst of messiness and imperfection. Embracing the inevitability of hardship, we learn to navigate the twists and turns of our own narratives with resilience and grace. Paulina offers sage advice drawing from the wisdom of those who have navigated similar challenges. Among the gems she shares is the concept of cultivating an aspirational alter ego, an empowering tool for personal growth and achievement. As our conversation unfolds, we delve deeper into the mechanics of success, exploring the role of systems and the indispensable nature of trust in our pursuits. As we reach the culmination of our discussion, we leave you with a stirring reflection on the essence of success, a reminder that its true measure lies not solely in achievement, but in the journey itself. Join us as we uncover the transformative power of storytelling, resilience, and trust, and embark on a journey toward realizing our fullest potential. Before we dive into the conversation, I'd like to extend my gratitude to my dear friend, Jordan Almscheid, for introducing me to Paulina. Jordan is the brilliant mind behind The Wealth Letters, a compilation of letters from accomplished individuals imparting their most profound life and business insights. If you haven't already, I highly encourage you to check out his previous episode on the show. It's a treasure trove of wisdom. Additionally, Jordan is currently immersed in an exciting new book project. Be sure to follow him on Substack for updates and exclusive content. All right, let's get started. Please help me welcome Paulina Pompliano. Hi, hello, Paulina. So nice to see you. How are you?
I'm good. I'm so excited to be here.
What a pleasure. We're both New Yorkers. So reading your book, yes. Stories of inspiration that came to you on the subway, it's very familiar to me. I feel like a lot of my ideas came to me on the subway, coming back from dinner or coming back from work or going to work. So I think New York subway has been a source of inspiration for a lot of us.
It really has. And it's funny because it's a source of inspiration, but it's also like the day I quit my job at Fortune Magazine, I got on the subway and I looked around and I was like, this is the biggest day of my life. Does nobody care? Because everybody was like doing things. And it's like, you realize how, you know, your story isn't the only story.
Uh-huh. And I'll come back to stories. I have a lot of questions about okay. Your book, about your writing, but I want to hear more about you. And I like to start these conversations with a question about the early days, childhood and upbringing. And I know you have a story. Would you be kind and indulge me with your childhood story?
Yes. So I was born in Bulgaria and I went to first and second grade there. And I was a very extroverted kid. And even at that age, even so little, I loved books. I loved writing. I still have a journal that I had when I was 6 years old. I would sign off everything that says 6 years old. So obviously, like, writing has been in my life forever. And then when I was eight, my parents won a green card in the green card lottery, and we moved to the U.S. We moved to Atlanta, Georgia, didn't speak English, and it was interesting because, well, I was in second grade there. They put me in fourth here. I don't know why. It's not because I was a math genius, probably something to do with my birthday, but I got to fourth grade, and I gotta say, Eastern Europe math in first grade, you're solving for X here. It was like 3 + 3, and I was like, I got this. In Bulgaria, I had a tutor here. I was a, you know, math prodigy. But not speaking the language and not being able to communicate, which was like, that was my life. Like, I can't, if I can't communicate, I can't write, I can't read. Right. So the first days were tough, but it really led me to observing people and paying attention to body language and paying attention to, you know, environmental cues. Where do people sit? Why do they look like that? Why are they, you know, it's just like you start paying attention to the things that you can't understand via language. So you start looking, like observing more.
So, you know, that I was born in Poland. I went to schools around Europe and I made New York my home. And I always felt like an outsider in many different situations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in Paris, I was on the board of the school, elected by students, and I was the only non-French kid at the table sometimes. And then I was in the U.S. pitching a stock, and everybody around the table was born in the US, I was not. And I always felt like it gave me a different perspective. Is that how you felt?
Oh, yeah. I think I still feel like an outsider. And it's funny that now I feel like an outsider in the US and in Bulgaria because people assume, oh, when you go back, you're just like, that's where you were born. But no, actually you adopt a lot of the American culture and norms and you go back and you're like, oh my gosh, like I don't think like this at all. So now I feel like an outsider here too. But I think being an outsider is probably my greatest advantage because you never take it for granted. You're always looking at the situation and you're like, I have multiple perspectives. I was born in Bulgaria. I grew up in the South. I live in New York now. That's three different layers of one situation that you can look at it from. So I think that gives me a little bit of, I don't know, an advantage of seeing something and not seeing the world as black and white. It's like there's so much more nuance and gray area that has helped me understand people better.
And it's a wider range of experiences. So when you look at a new problem, you tap into a whole big library of very different situations that you experience. And I think it's very, very helpful. And I grew to appreciate over time, you know, sitting down with folks that grew up in the US in one town, then moved to New York. And here I came and, you know, growing up in Poland in the 1980s, very different economic system and so on. And then living in Paris and then Brussels and coming to New York. I feel like all those little stories, and I'll ask you about stories in a second, but all of them make up who we are, but allow us to see things in a, as you said, in a more nuanced way. It's a scale of very different shades of gray to contemplate. I want to ask you about school. You have this story in your book at the beginning that I really liked. You said that you dreaded history at school, but you loved stories. And I love stories, and I learn history through stories. I don't remember the dates. I don't remember the generals. So I can completely relate to that. But I want to hear what it was like to live during Roman times in Rome. If you're rich, if you're poor, if you're in the army, what was it really like? So that's how I learned history. So tell me about that experience of looking for stories, because it led to some revelations that you share in your book, and then led you to writing, and specifically writing Hidden Genius, the book that we want to talk about today.
Yeah, it was. So when I was growing up, I just assumed that I didn't like history. I don't like it. I can't memorize. I can't remember dates, all this stuff. Like those were my complaints. And then I took this history class and there it was an AP class in high school. And I was like, okay, well, I mean, this is a lot of information. This is going to be really, really tough to kind of navigate if I don't have a system in place. So it was the French Revolution. It was that period of time that I was captivated by. And I wasn't, the whole period was interesting, but it wasn't just the period. I was like very intrigued Marie Antoinette. She was this young queen. She was very naive. She was 19 years old. They wanted to, she became kind of a symbol of excess and everything that was wrong with the world and everybody hated her. And I was like, oh my God, like this is a lot and very interesting. So I started digging into her life and I started to understand. I was like, oh, okay. Well, even if the things that in the newspapers were printed weren't true about her, this is how it was perceived. And she became a symbol of something that people despised. And she ultimately walked to her own death by guillotine. And it's such a dramatic life story. And I was like, wow, if I put myself as a human being in her shoes, I wonder what she was feeling. So I came at it from a place of like, I wonder how this person felt instead of like, this happened, this happened, this happened. And it's like very clinical and dry. So once I learned, I was like, okay, well, I can do this with anything. And every time we studied a new period of history, I would choose the main characters, like a story, and I would go deep on their life and try to imagine what it was like for them. Because, like, as we've seen, we all just lived through a global pandemic, which was wildly different for you, for me, for a single mom with three kids. So it's like, you can't, there is no objective truth of exactly how it went. There's context, there's nuance, there's, you know, it affected people so, so differently. So I wish that, you know, teachers had the time to figure out all of their students' learning styles and teach them that way. But for me, I just very early on realized that my learning style was, I call it in the book, people focused or people driven. It's that a person's story is at the center of any learning pursuit. So I've structured my life and my learning and the thing that I work on, the profile, in a way where I choose a person and I'm like, who is the best person to teach me about this one thing? And I look at it from that lens, and that's how I learn. Most people start with the idea first. I start with the person first and then back my way into the idea.
I love the sound of that. You know, there's this concept that more people have lived so far on Earth than are living today. And if we can learn their stories, right? Such a powerful image to think about. So what we think, you know, in my business, Managing Money for Families, people think that they're the first ones to experience something. And I think we all have that moment where we feel like, oh, I'm the first one experiencing it. But it's not really the case. Many people are experiencing something similar right now. And if you look back to the past, you will probably find a lot of people that had a similar experience and challenges and questions and problems than you're having right now.
Yeah. And I think that's what I find. When I started my newsletter, The Profile, years before I started it, when I had first moved to New York, I was kind of like, I was experiencing these weird feelings of, oh my gosh, I'm 22 years old. I don't know what I'm doing with my life. I thought I would have achieved way more. Like I'd be on a path of something different. And I didn't feel that way. So I was like, I wonder, I just happened to come across Sarah Blakely's story, the creator of Spanx. Mm-hmm. And I saw how she had failure after failure after failure until she finally hit on something she loved. And her story resonated so deeply with me. I was like, wow, okay, exactly what you said. Somebody's been through something like this. Let me study the way they navigated it. And maybe I won't do the same, but at least I can see, like, I can see, okay, this is one path, this is another path. Do I want to make similar decisions and have the same trade-offs and the same, make the same sacrifices, or will I do it my own way? It's just, it's comforting to know that there's people who have been where you've been, done what you've done, and you can see how their life turned out. Sometimes it's not a life you want, but it's at least you have the information to make better decisions.
Paulina, reading your book, I wrote to myself that success is messy. You write about the willingness to fail, and then you say how imperfection can lead to a masterpiece. I like both ideas. Tell me more about that messy success.
So success is always messy. If somebody happens to be watching this interview, they will see that I am wearing different clothes in a totally different setting. It's because we had some technical difficulties. But it hopefully becomes a successful podcast. The reason that I included that is because I think when people see a book that says, you know, studying the world's most successful people, they immediately think, oh, but like, you know, that's hero worship and like you're only studying the successes. And it's like, well, but what you don't understand is that the road to that success is very messy. It's not linear. It's very loopy and winding. And so many people failed miserably and fell flat on their face before they ever tasted success. And to me, if you read the book, the stories that are most interesting to me are the ones where somebody has achieved a little bit of success, then failed miserably, then learned from that failure, and then gone on to achieve something that they've wanted to achieve again. So in the book, I talk about Ed Catmull, who's the co-founder of Pixar. And Pixar's movies are very original. They are things that you've never really seen before, and they stick with you. Like Ratatouille is about a rat that can cook. Easily, that kind of concept could have failed miserably. It could have been disgusting, a disgusting movie about a rat in a kitchen. Or Toy Story could have been like overly commercial. It's a movie about toys and material possessions, but they made it very human and interesting in a way that, you know, it had a really big potential to fail. So mm-hmm. Ed Catmull, he says, you know, we really like the ideas that have a big potential to fail, and then we just iterate and iterate and fail and iterate again until we hit on something that, you know, makes sense and is interesting and is as close to perfect as we can make it. It's not going to be perfect because it's still going to be, you know, he's like, whenever I see the final version of a film, I'm still like, ooh, that's not good. But it's the best of, like, what we've done. And he says, you know, honestly, when people say, ooh, that's a failure, he's like, that's not even mm-hmm. the right word to use, because mm-hmm. it's only a failure if you didn't learn from it and change it and iterate. Mm-hmm. So the other example that I really like, this one's not in the book, but I think about it often. Taylor Swift, or maybe it is in the book. I don't remember. But Taylor Swift has, she had a song, and it's, the lyric was, I've got a long list of ex-lovers. But when she's singing it, what people heard is mm-hmm. a long list of Starbucks, or a star, yeah, I, a long list of that. Starbucks.
It's in the book. No. It's in the book.
Yeah. It is in the book. Okay. No, so it's, the original lyric is a long list of, ex-lovers, and what people heard was all the lonely Starbucks lovers. That's an imperfection. It's mm-hmm. it's an imperfection because people didn't hear how she meant for it to read or listen to. So because of that imperfection, though, her song became really sticky and really memorable, mm-hmm. and people started talking about it. Articles mm-hmm. were written, videos were made. And that song ended up on as number one on the Billboard chart for 9 straight weeks. And it's like there's an element of the flaw actually made it successful, mm-hmm. you know? So I think, like, people really can't beat themselves up about, oh, because my path isn't perfect and not exactly how I planned it, that means that it's a failure and I'll never reach success. It's actually, success is a whole bunch of things mixed together. And mm-hmm. sometimes that works. And even though it's imperfect, it becomes a success.
I love what I'm hearing. And I'm thinking how we always see success as a final product. And we don't really mm-hmm. have a chance to see how did we get there, or how did somebody get there? And I think we're obsessing about having this easy and straight path to it. But we know it's not the case. And when you profile somebody, it's very tricky to show how windy of a road it was to get there. There are ups and downs. There are moments when they almost gave up. There are moments that you mentioned. It was an imperfection that led actually to an idea, which happened in so many businesses, that this plan B, other idea, became the main idea over time and took over the whole business. And that's what the business is about today. I was thinking, I had Corey Wren and Dan Pacaud on the show, who have been going to Berkshire Hathaway mm-hmm. meetings 40-some years. And Corey Wren was actually an early accountant and auditor for Berkshire Hathaway. And when he got mm-hmm. a call from a headhunter to join Buffett, he said, I don't know who Buffett is. I don't know what Berkshire Hathaway is, and I'm not going to Omaha. So today, when we think of Berkshire as something that we all knew what it is, and everybody knew who Buffett was today. But at the time, nobody knew who he was. And he was just working really hard out of his office in Omaha in a nondescript building and compounding to the point that we all noticed who he is. But it wasn't an easy path. And, you know, the textile business that Berkshire was went away and on and on and on. There wasn't. Yeah, it was a series of events that led to where we are today.
And, you know, I just want to, as you're talking, it kind of reminded me, I think success is a very similar to the concept of luck. You can mm-hmm. only deem something successful or lucky looking backwards. Like, in the moment, you don't know. But when you mm-hmm. look back, you're like, oh, man, that was a lucky thing. Like, for example, in the book, I tell the story of Francis Ngannou, who's this great MMA champion. But when he first started, he had this long, winding road to get to where he is, to the United States. And he, like, travel through the Sahara Desert, tried to get from Morocco to Spain with refugees. Like, he had this insane path. And then when I was talking to him, I told him that my family won the green card in the green card lottery to come to the U.S. And he was like, I played that every year. And people called me unlucky because I never got it. He's like, but if I had won it and if I had come to the U.S. the easy way with a green card, then I would probably be working as like a security guard somewhere. I don't think I would have had the success that I did unless I took this like really difficult path. So sometimes, you know, what people are like, ooh, that's unlucky. Like, she went to America on a green card. Why didn't you? And then it's like, yeah, but that would have been very unlucky for him. And he wouldn't have enjoyed the success that he had.
I love that story. And it leads up beautifully to the question I have about hardship. And you have this quote that I really liked. You said that suffering begets progress. And I had many conversations on this podcast about all kinds of hardship that people went through. And at the time, it feels like you don't want it. You don't deserve it. Why are you getting it? But then when people look back decades later, they realize that that hardship redirected them in a way, inspired them in a way, and they were able to accomplish something. Can you share your thoughts about hardship? What a role it plays in those success stories that you profile?
Here's what I've learned about hardship is that, like many people, before I started writing this book and interviewing these people, I kind of was on the defensive. I waited for hardship to come to me, and then I'd deal with it. So we all know the involuntary hardship. Somebody dies, you get fired from your job, you lose your home, you lose your marriage, whatever it is. It's like, You're waiting. And then life inevitably has one of its blows. And then you're just like shaken and you don't know what to do. You don't know how to react or move on. And you're sitting there in the spiral of depression. So I was like, how do you become more resilient, though? We see these people who are able to bounce back faster. Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett's partner, who recently passed away, he... very few people know, in a matter of, I think, months or a year, he, you know, got, his marriage fell apart, his son died, he lost his eye, he became, like, partially blind, all these things happened to him, but he was like, you know, I went on a walk, I realized, okay, well, I've been feeling so sorry for myself, I need to stop that, how can I become more resilient, so I'm not as, you know, taken aback by some of these crazy life events that the universe serves your way. So I started looking at people who, like a David Goggins, former Navy SEAL who became an ultra athlete. How do you invite hardship into your life so that you're more, he calls it callous the mind. Your brain is tougher and better able to deal with the involuntary difficulties on a daily basis. So what he does is voluntary hardship. He's like, every single day, I will do one thing that I don't want to do, one thing that sucks. So he's like, every day I'll go on, you know, for him, it's like maybe a 100-mile run. No. But like for me, it would be every single day, get up, go work out or do a run, even if it's raining, even if it's snowing. Nobody wants to do that. But what it tells your brain is, I've made this promise to myself to do this every single day. I'm going to do it. And then after you do it, you're like, I just did that. Like, your brain gets a little bit tougher. And it's not just physical things. It's also mental things. So, for example, I really do not like public speaking. I don't like being on a stage by myself talking to an audience. I get really nervous, all this stuff. But when an opportunity arises for me to do that, I force myself to accept it because I know that just a little bit, it'll build a little bit of confidence. Another thing that, you know, you can do at home if you're listening is, like, let's say you really don't like negotiating. Okay, well, in life, you're going to have to negotiate a business deal or a raise with your boss or something like that. So find small moments in the day where you can negotiate. Sell something on Facebook Marketplace and negotiate, you know? So it's like small, invite small difficulties into your day where it builds up, like you said, compounds over time, so that when the involuntary blows come, you're less fragile.
You're ready for it at that time. You're prepared. You've been training for it. And I like that image.
Yeah.
Because it's almost, you know, physical training, but it's a mental, emotional, psychological training. And it's not that the path to a success, however you define success, will be easy and smooth. You know there will be obstacles, and it's not about avoiding those obstacles, but I think being ready to handle them and go through them. A certain persistence, endurance, mm-hmm. resilience. I think these are big, big words that I really like, that it's not about that it's going to be easy, but you'll keep on showing up again and again and again. And I like this idea that you have, that you can train yourself to show up even for the smallest inconveniences, like going for a run in the middle of the rain. Mm-hmm. Because when the real thing comes up, you won't even think twice about it. You'll go ahead and you'll do it. I like that image.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You have this idea in the book that made me really pause and think. And a couple of the heroes that you introduce use something that you describe as alternative ego, alter ego. And they separate their past selves or the present selves that doesn't serve them right now, that self, and they're developing this new potential future self. They even name those different selves. And I like this idea because I think we might be so stuck in a definition of who we are. You know, even you brought up public speaking. I used to be very uncomfortable doing any public speaking, and I went through a Toastmaster training, and I'm much more comfortable now. I still get anxious about it. I tap into it and make it happen. But I realized that having this image that I'm not a good public speaker, it's the past, right? You can reshape it. Can you talk about this idea of an alter ego, alternative ego, in the sense that you can build a completely different, almost, you know, characteristic quality about yourself if you choose to?
Yes, this is such a useful psychological tool that if we figure out how to use it, it can actually be very beneficial in any area of your life. So for me, the first time I kind of was exposed to this idea and saw it in action is when I was in high school. I had an acting class as one of my electives in high school. Even though I was so shy and so introverted, I was like, oh, take this acting class. And then our final assignment was a monologue that you had prepared as someone and to deliver it in front of the class. And I was like, oh, I was dreading it all semester. I was like, I do not know how I'm going to get up there and talk. I would get like nauseous just thinking about it. So I talked to my teacher and he told me something interesting. He was like, okay, I know how you are in your real life. You're very nervous about this, whatever. But like this character that you will be delivering this monologue as, they have thoughts, they have feelings, they're very confident. Like he was like, when you get up on that stage, you need to not be you, but you need to be this person and embody them fully. So, you know, right. Act confident, take up space, like you use your voice in a certain way. I was like, whoa. So I was like, I felt a lot more comfortable that I wasn't showing up as Paulina, who's shy and introverted, but as this very like extroverted, confident character. Mm-hmm. For some reason, my mind was like, oh, that's not you. Like, this is someone else. It's weird, but it works. So I got up there, I delivered it, and I was so confident on stage. And then I got off and I was like, how do I access that again? So then I learned about this idea of an alter ego that a lot of athletes and celebrities use that I wasn't aware of. So, for example, I mentioned David Goggins. He used to be very insecure about himself. He was actually obese. Before he became a Navy SEAL, he was spraying for cockroaches. That was his job. And suddenly he was like, I cannot achieve the things that I want to achieve if I have this image of myself. And he was like, the image right. of me, David, was that I was a weak, insecure kid who got bullied at school, who suffered abuse at the hands of his father. Like, I don't want to think about that anymore. That's like my past. So he gave himself a new name. So instead of going by David, he now goes by Goggins. And his whole idea was, Goggins was not born, he was built. So like, I built this character that's like my aspirational self. Yeah, the built, not born mantra that he has. So he's like, I have this character of Goggins that's my aspirational, my ideal self, who I want to become. So he does things that he thinks this person would do. He runs, he does things that are uncomfortable. He doesn't succumb to the whatever that insecure kid wanted to do, sit on the couch and whine about his life. Another person that does this well is Beyonce. She used to be very introverted, but you cannot be a powerhouse that you are, that you have to be on stage to perform at her level. So she created something called Sasha Fierce. It was just an alter ego where she was like, she's this like sexy, confident person on stage. She is nothing like Beyonce. And then Kobe Bryant, who was a very successful basketball player, he went through a period in his career where he would go out on the court and people would boo him and tell him, get off the court, you suck, whatever. And that's really hard to hear, you know, Kobe, you suck, when you're about to play a big game. So he was right. Like, when I go out on that court, I'm not Kobe anymore. I'm the Black Mamba, which is this like big black snake. He's like, I'm going to attack the game. So it started not to faze him because in that moment, he was not Kobe. And I found in my research that really interesting that actually an alter ego gives you a little bit of distance from your actual self. And therapists use this with people with PTSD or people with like severe depression, which is that they have them talk in the third person as if they're narrating someone else's life, because that gives them a little bit of distance of like, me, this is how I feel, whatever. This way you're able to see it as an observer in a more objective way. And so I think that that's so valuable in that you create just like a vision of someone you want to be, and you're like, how does this person act? And if you start acting like them today, then you eventually, that's the beauty of alter egos. So Beyonce had this, but then now she's like, I don't need that anymore because I became her, you know? Ultimately, as you do it more and more, you start to become this like ideal character that you have in your head, because you just do it more, you practice it more. Like you said, Toastmasters, like it's the same idea. The more you do it, the more it compounds, the more you feel like this person. I today have nothing in common with the girl in high school who was super introverted and would never do a podcast with you, you know? So it's just like, they eventually the two identities like melt together.
I'm thinking of a growth mindset, because what you're saying is kind of a permission to allow yourself to grow. And it's funny because we see ourselves through our own eyes, but we see ourselves through the eyes of other people. And it's so common for people that we know in our life to say, this is so not you, right? Like you and I talking and saying, I'll do a TED talk. And you would say, well, it's so not you. How are you going to do it, right? And you have to separate and create a completely new identity in the moment. That new person is capable of going up on that stage like you did with your acting class and tapping into all those skills that you do have. Because it was you that was on that stage, and you actually do it and deliver the speech.
And one more thing, like I would challenge people to think about identity as being very slippery and not reliable. I think most people get stuck because they're like, this is who I am. Like I cannot do a TED talk. I do not speak on stage. I'm an introvert. Blah, blah, blah. So I would challenge you to think about identity as this like constantly evolving thing. Because if I ask you, who is the true you, is it, are you, is your real identity who you were 5 years ago, who you are in this moment, or who you're going to be in 20 years? Like, who is the real you? Because you're constantly changing. So, I mean, and people are like, wait a second, I guess me today, but like, that's not who I want to be. And that's not who I used to be. So it's like, you can be anybody, and you can develop into those things. It's just whether you prioritize it or not.
I have this random thought that I have to bring up. I'm thinking of the change of the environment. You know, you and I changed countries and schools at different points of our life, and even chose the language we speak most of the day. You know, for me, it was Polish. Then it was, for a while, it was French. Now it's English. And you change the environment, you change the people, and the fact that you even speak a different language allows you to be experiment with who you are, especially in that stage when you're growing up and going to schools and so on. I'm curious if you have some thoughts about it, because, you know, kids change schools and they kind of have a second chance not to hear anybody tell them this is so not you, because the kids at that school don't know who you are. You have a second chance.
Oh, yeah. Also, I've written about this. I think it's really interesting, especially with people who speak different languages or have grown up in different cultures. I noticed this a few years ago when I went back to Bulgaria, and I was like, oh, it's so weird. When I speak Bulgarian, I feel more logical and more structured and more direct when I talk to people. When I speak English, I'm more like roundabout. I'm not as direct. I'm very extroverted. And I'm like, is it me or is it the language? And then I started just reading all this stuff. And actually, what they've learned is that, yes, different languages, actually, the words that you use matter, and it sparks different feelings in you. So, for example, in many Eastern European countries, if you think about how you talk, a lot of it, the language isn't very emotional, you know? True. So I noticed that in Bulgaria, when I am about to say something, I say, I think. Like, I think that we have to do this. I think I should be whatever. In the U.S., we often say, I feel like we should go to the park today. It's like, why are you using feel? You want to go to the park, or you think you should go to the park. But feel, it's like you're injecting emotion in a sentence that does not need emotion injected into it. So like that, you know, we become, maybe we are more emotional speaking English than we would be if we were in an environment like a Bulgaria or Poland. You know what I mean?
I think there's some truth to it. I feel like the language allows us to be different. Oh, there you go. You set me up with that one. But there is some truth to it. And there is some truth to it. And yeah, I catch myself. You know, when people say, in which language are you thinking or dreaming? And I always thought that, well, again, thoughts and dreams are not in a language. I can't say, unless the dream was very specific, that I didn't understand what somebody said or I was trying to explain something, but the dreams and thoughts are not in a language. They're in its own code, in a way, in an image, a feeling, as you said. But when we move between cultures, the language changes. Like in English, there's so many words that talk about excitement. I'm looking forward. Like when I write an email and I sometimes pause and I read it to myself in Polish, I would never write an email to somebody like that in a work context that I'm excited to see you, I'm looking forward, right? No, I would be much more proper in a way. You know, I don't know even what words I would use, but it wouldn't be, you wouldn't hear the enthusiasm and excitement.
No. And by the way, English, right now I'm promoting, oh, sorry.
No, no, you in English you're allowed to do it. It's a permission to do it, yeah.
Yes, and it's just a much more, like you said, excited. I'm looking forward to it. I'm currently promoting my book in Bulgaria, and I've been exchanging emails with reporters and my translator, and I have to catch myself because I use way too many exclamation points. I'm saying, like, everything is wonderful. I'm like, they're going to think I am insane. Like, I'm so excited about everything, and they're not. And, it, of course, it's like a cultural element, but I do think, like, what you said, especially as a kid, when you're in different environments, you're like a chameleon. You're like, oh, okay, like, I see the way you look at the world, and like we talked about previously, perspective is something that people who haven't traveled or experienced different cultures lack, because you can only see the world in black and white. Whereas you and me, like, we know why some people vote the way they do. We know why some people say the things they do or do the things they do. And it's like, because we have these different like layers or prisms of experience, and you can see, oh yeah, well, when I grew up there, this is what people thought. And like, even if it's propaganda, this is why they think this way. So I just like never really judge people, because it's like, I understand that it's the environment, the who you surround yourself with, the politicians, like everything. And you can't decouple that. And it doesn't exist in a vacuum. Like, a person is not black and white.
I like this idea that I never walked in your shoes. I can empathize. I can hear your story, but I never walked in your shoes. I don't know what it felt like, right? I guess at the end of the day, I can be as human as I can be to understand where you're coming from. But understanding that it's a much more nuanced way of looking at the world that I have to respect, and I choose to respect, and I want to respect where you're coming from and why do you feel or think in a certain way. I was going to... Now I'm going to use both at the same time. But you brought up your book, and it was translated to your language, to your mother tongue. And I was going to ask you about it because I saw you posted about it. How did it feel to read the book that you wrote in English, I understand, in Bulgarian? What was it like?
Okay, this is so crazy because a year ago, my book was published. I should not be this excited about it. But it just, and by the way, the book has been translated, you know, in multiple languages already, but Bulgarian, it just, it means a lot to me because obviously that's where I come from, but also because my entire family is still there, except for my parents who are here. So I have cousins, I have aunts, I have grandmothers, great-grandmothers, grandfathers, like I have a lot of people there who have never read anything that I have ever written because they don't speak English. So now it just like, it's awesome because they can take the book and read and be like, oh, so like that's what she does. I don't think my grandmother thought that I had a job because she didn't think like writing was a job. Like, what is that? So now I was like, all it took was getting a book published and translated in Bulgarian to, you know, prove that I do have a job. But the idea is like it's so cool. It's the coolest feeling. And also I wrote a foreword specifically for the Bulgarian audience. And in it I said, you know, I kind of dedicated the foreword to my first and second grade teacher in Bulgaria. She is someone who we're still in touch. She really encouraged me at such a young age to keep writing. And she was like, yeah, I remember the math problems with the words weren't your favorite, but everything else was. I was like, yeah, you're right. but it's just like, you get to kind of repay the people who have helped you and who have like supported your journey. I don't know. It's just like the coolest feeling. I love it.
When you read a couple of pages, does it read the way you heard it in your head when you're writing those pages
in
English?
Absolutely not.
No.
Absolutely not. I read it and I was like, oh yeah, like that is what that is in Bulgarian. But I never thought about it. Like it's a completely different like map of the world. But it is cool because it opens your eyes. I had my dad and my mom read it in Bulgarian to tell me, like, does this sound good? And my dad was, like, editing, like, changing things. I was like, no. Your role is not to edit my book now. It's just, like, does this sound good to you? But it is cool. Like, it reminded me when you left Poland.
I was 19, 20.
19. Yeah. So I was an adult.
Yeah.
But still, even so, so much of the vocabulary has changed. So I find myself like using old words that are not in use today. Now it's like a cool, hip, new American word, and I'm still like in the 1995. but it is very, very interesting to see the how it was translated because it does sound completely different in my head.
Well, you're going to laugh. I speak Polish and it's my language and I talk to my family.
Yeah.
But I had to go to a bank not long ago in Poland and I haven't visited a bank. And I work in the money business. I invest money for people. So you would think that I'm fairly fluent in that vocabulary. And I am in a language or two. But I was sitting at a bank and getting an app and tokens and pins and all those different words. And I was just lost. You know, I can ask the question, but I don't know the words. Once they say it, I can guess. I think that's what you meant.
Yes.
You mean a pin, or you mean this or that. I mean, some of the words are similar, but it's a whole new language that got developed around the new world of apps and clicks and likes and all those things.
Yeah, when I left, there was not a word. I mean, I didn't know what a newsletter was, let alone like what is the word for newsletter. And now it's like, that's what I do every day, yet I don't know the word for newsletter. It's crazy.
Yeah, that's the beauty of living between languages and appreciating the differences. Paulina, I want to ask you about trust. You actually bring up Charlie Munger there, somebody we brought up already. He had this idea of a seamless web of deserved trust. I'm very curious about it because trust is something that you can't buy. You earn it. You deserve it over time. And it's very crucial in lifelong relationships, both in personal life, but also in business. Can you talk about trust and how important it is on this path that we talk about today to success?
Yeah, I think trust in personal relationships, professional relationships, business relationships, like it's the foundation of everything that we do. And, you know, my first introduction to trust, well, not my first introduction, but like I realized just how important it is in a professional setting when I started the profile in February of 2017, my newsletter. It was free. And I kept sending it week after week, year after year. So to this day, 7 years later, I still haven't missed a single Sunday to send it out. But I was like, you know, that was just like a personal thing. I never thought about it as like, oh, wait a second. That reliability actually builds trust with the readers to the point where if I accidentally like schedule it for a later time or a different day when I'm scheduling the email to go out, if it's 25 minutes late, people will email me and be like, are you okay? Is everything all right? I didn't get it at 7:03 this morning. It's like, yes, I am good, but thank you for checking on me. So if I ever go missing, the profile readers will know first.
They'll know.
But but the idea is that because I've been sending it week after week, I sent it for free for 3 years. So I started earning the trust of the readers in those 3 years. Then in 2020, when I was like, I'm gonna now open a paid layer and you can back the profile with your dollars, people trusted me enough to back me financially. Otherwise, like you can't ask for people's, you know, money or to trust you with their finances when you haven't been reliable and you've been like, oh yeah, I said I'd send it every week, but actually I'm taking a 2 week vacation, so you're not gonna get it for two. Like it's not, it's a product. And I take it very seriously. Like, I think when whatever it is that you do, if you take it seriously, other people will as well. And so I heard Reid Hoffman, founder of LinkedIn, investor, he once said, consistency plus time equals trust. So if you're a consistent person and you do something consistently over a long period of time, trust is inevitable. People who constantly break their promises, even if they have good reasons to break those promises, we just naturally are like, I don't know. I don't know if I can trust you. And I've been in that situation. Like, I, of all people, understand how hard it is to send a newsletter, how much work it takes, how long it takes. Yet, when I pay for a newsletter and the like person's like, all right, peace out, I'm gone for the next month, I'm like, okay, but like, I just signed up, you know? So I don't have a great experience. And I think Charlie, what he was saying, like a web of deserved trust. He's like, there is no higher, you know, civilization than that because that's how, you know, doctors operate. That's how like everything operate. Everything very important operates, has to operate on trust. If trust breaks down, everything breaks down. We saw that happen when a lot of people lost in the last 4 or 5 years, lost a lot of trust in institutions. So all these like little things started popping up. And Charlie Munger makes a joke. He's like, you know, if your proposed marriage contract is 47 pages, I suggest you not enter, because he's talking about a prenup. But again, like if you're starting a marriage off based on like, I trust you, but it's hard. So it's not impossible, but it's hard. So I think like I agree with him that everything, the foundation of everything is trust. And if you apply that principle in your personal life and your professional life, it will improve.
Buffett and Munger are famous for signing their early deals on a page or two. And they said, if you need a room full of lawyers, maybe you shouldn't be part of that deal.
Yeah.
And the world got more complicated since. I think we signed much longer contracts. I feel like even simple services online include a 200-page disclosure that you have to sign off. I don't know.
What happened to the handshake deal? Yeah.
It's just an email. But speaking of trust, you share a story that I really want to bring up. It's a story of an activist who helped end the war in Liberia. And she has a quote that's in your book, that it takes time to earn trust, build credibility, and truly understand the needs of the people who live there every day. The reason I bring it up is, to me, I was thinking about serving others. In so many professions, we serve others. You serve others with the work you do. I serve my clients whose money I manage. And to earn that kind of trust, credibility, you have to put yourself in their shoes and you have to come from a certain place. And that's the part of your book that really made me feel something. Can you share that story?
Yeah. Yeah. It was a moment. It was so interesting. So she did a panel. She did like a onstage conversation where she was being interviewed at Columbia University. And someone in the audience asked a question. And it was like a student from Colombia. And he was like, hey, I'm originally from Nigeria. I've grown up here, but I want to go back and help, you know? Like, I want to go back and serve the people of Nigeria. That's where I'm from. And she looked at him and she was just like, oh, yeah? Like, what are you going to do? And he was like, she was like, what are you going to do for somebody like me? Like, you think that you're going to come into a country with your Columbia education and you're going to say, I'm so educated, I have all this experience, let me fix this. And she's like, that's not how it works. You cannot build trust that way. People see you as self-serving and someone who just like wants to fly in, fix things and leave, whether it's with money or whatever you want to do. The point is that like the people on the ground know the truth. Like, that's why it's when you're working at a company or something and they hire somebody new, they just like fly in. They're like, let me solve all your problems. Like, that's not how it works. Talk to the people who are there, but not just talk. Like, if you want to create lasting, meaningful change, you should probably go spend a significant amount of time with the people that you want to help. I would not be the best person to go, you know, run for president in Bulgaria. Because, not because I'm not interested in politics whatsoever, but because I haven't lived there. I don't know what people need. It's just like, it's so ignorant and kind of like patronizing. I don't know. It's just like elitist to think that, oh, yeah, like I'm from this country. I have this like Ivy League education. I'm going to go fix the problems. It's like, that's not how it works. And until you genuinely understand the people on the ground and their point of view and how they feel, all this stuff, that's when you can create meaningful change because they'll respect you. And again, I think it's like the consistency over time. They don't know who this person is. He's going to come in and say, I have all these credentials. They don't care. It's like, have you been here with us fighting every day, protesting, being an activist every single day? And it's like, if you do that for a long period of time, you'll start to earn their trust. But the fly-in, like, I'm just going to throw money at the problem or like, I'm this big, important person, it just never works.
It makes me think that serving others takes a lot of empathy and almost ego-free approach where you really go in and you can't walk in their shoes, but you try to get as close as possible to truly understand how is it that I can help. And you have to leave all the other agendas outside of the conversation because they won't help and they might get you in trouble. Exactly. I want to bring up another big idea that's in your book that really spoke to me as an investor. You know, I'm thinking of principles, philosophy, basically the systems and the outcomes. And you have a quote from Bob Bowman, Mike Phelps's coach, who said, focus on perfecting systems instead of outcomes, and the outcomes take care of themselves. And it really spoke to me as an idea, not just in business investing, but in life in general, how sometimes we're so obsessed about the outcome. I want to have $1 million, or I want to be the richest person in town, or I don't know, I want to have the biggest house or the nicest car, or whatever it is that you think that you have to have. But then if you want to get somewhere, climb a mountain, what's the system that would get you there? We spend too little time thinking about the system. It's such a mindset shift in that chapter of the book. Can you talk about it? System over the outcome.
Yes. So this is kind of an idea that I got from like a lot of different places. One of the most influential was James Clear in his book on habits. And it's like, for example, when I was training for my... I ran a marathon. I ran the original marathon in Greece. So from marathon Greece to Athens. Yeah. Fun fact. One marathon, never again. But I ran it and I trained for that thing so much. I trained every day so long, so hard, because my outcome, my goal was to run this marathon. But once I ran the marathon, I didn't run for 2 years. Like, that was it. I was like... And I used to like running. So I think that most people look at the outcome and they're like, I'm going to run this marathon. Like, that's the outcome. And they train up to it. And then once it's over, you're done. Like, you don't, there is no, like, you are not a runner anymore. And I think the point is, like, if you have a good system, you don't, that's just kind of like a blip in your process. You tell yourself, I am a runner. And my system is I run every day or whatever. But like, that's like a lifestyle instead of I'm just focused on this one outcome and I'm going to do whatever it takes and then never run again. And I like the Bob Bowman quote a lot, and it reminds me of Nick Saban, who was Alabama's football coach. He said, don't look at the scoreboard, play the next play. So the whole idea is like, if you focus on getting your job done, then the whole thing works. The reason that a football play doesn't work is because one person was looking at the scoreboard and not focusing on their job in this play. Right. So it's like focus on the tiny systems of your everyday life, and then the outcome will take care of itself. If instead I had been like, I just run every day. Like, that's what I do. I just like run every day. I don't... But that wasn't my mindset. My mindset was, I'm going to do exactly down to the last thing what my plan says to do to run this freaking marathon. And then, like, once it's over, I'm done. There was no system beneath it. So a lot of chess players know this. You know, if you're focused on the outcome, you can prevent one, like, mistake from happening again. But focusing on the system, you can prevent hundreds of similar mistake. If you find out what you're doing that's wrong in your system, then you could kind of prevent the mistakes that you will make in the future. So it's very interesting. It's like... audit the systems in your day and you will see why you're getting the outcomes that you're getting, even if you're not aiming for a specific outcome.
Yeah, it's such a powerful idea about systems and outcomes, how the world works. And I think there are so many scorecards for us to watch out there, you know, from net worth to winning games and so on. But we might be forgetting the game we're playing and how do we stay in that game.
Right.
What's the system that would allow us to keep on showing up and the outcomes will follow? It's very hard to accept that you don't have to focus on the outcome. The outcome will follow. So when it came from the coach of Michael Phelps, I've had, if somebody knows, he knows. And he got in places with this mindset. So if it worked for him, it could work for us in all kinds of pursuits.
Exactly.
Let's bring up Matthew McConaughey. You have an idea from him, maybe more than one, but the one that really stood out to me, he talks about identity elimination diet. And then you add more on the topic later on that I really liked. You said that once you establish your foundational values, you won't be tempted to break them in difficult situations because the promise you've made to yourself is more important than any opportunity. I really like the combination, the marriage of those two ideas, how we talked about, like, who are we, the identity part, but once you're really, really sure about who you are and what's important to you in whatever career you're in, then it gets so much easier to say yes or no to all kinds of opportunities. Like, this is definitely not something I would do, and this is definitely something I have to be a part of. Can you talk about that? I really like that.
Yes, yes. Okay, so what most people do is they're like, who do I want to be? And like, what can I do to become that person? But actually, before you do that, the most effective thing that you could do is ask, who do I not want to be? And Francis Ngannou, that we mentioned earlier, he said that for him, when he was growing up, his dad was this like violent, abusive, like street fighter man. And he saw that and he was like, okay, I do not want to be that. Like, I don't want to, he saw, you know, him drinking. He was like, I don't want to drink. Because I see where that leads. I don't want to be abusive. I don't want to be like fighting with people, all this stuff. So he was like, and he says like his dad was super valuable to him in his life because it was an example of who he didn't want to become. So once you know who you don't want to be, it's easier to be like, okay, well, what are the habits of the person that I do want to be? And Matthew McConaughey, what he says about the identity elimination diet, the whole point is removing the bad habits that make you who you are today. So he was like, if you feel bad after you hang out with your friend, your current friends, eliminate. Get rid of them. Like, that sounds harsh, but like, if you don't feel good, or if you feel really bad about yourself after being with them, then maybe they're not for you. If you go to the same bar every weekend, you have a really bad hangover the next day, eliminate that. Like, it's just get rid of all the toxic things in your life to make room for the things that you do want. So for Francis, for example, once he realized who he didn't want to be, he was like, okay, well, now what is my aspirational self want to be? He started as a teenager in Cameroon living as a professional boxer. So obviously he wasn't a professional boxer, but he was like, how do they act? They don't drink, they don't smoke, they work out every day. And like, he went on to list these things that were aspirational. That's just how he lived. So I think the reason the quote that you read about the foundational values is that, for example, on January 1st, 2021, I stopped drinking all alcohol. I was like, I'm just not going to drink. And it's what I mentioned earlier with James Clear. It's like your identity-based habits. Suddenly, I'm just not a drinker. I went to like a fun party, but I'm like, oh, but this is no exception because I am not a drinker. It's not I don't drink. It's I am, or like I sometimes don't. It's like this is who I am. So I didn't feel the pressure of breaking my streak just because there are no exceptions. And it's like that. It's like once you know your foundational values, no amount of temptation will force you to break them.
I really like that idea of being honest with yourself who you don't want to be. You know, I sometimes when I talk to clients and they look at the portfolio of investments, I tell them it's not just what's in the portfolio, but what we chose not to put in the portfolio. But it's the same with identity, personality. It's the same idea. You choose what you're going to have in the basket and you choose the things you're not going to have in the basket. The path forward gets clearer and clearer as you go. If you do that exercise consistently, it's tricky, depending. Yeah.
Sorry, one more thing that I just remembered. I think that it starts with like truth, and a lot of people, their blind spots are that they don't want to face who they are because it brings up negative things or whatever. So when we were talking about alter ego, David Goggins, one of the practices that he did in the beginning to become this ideal self is he calls it the accountability mirror. He went in the bathroom, looked at himself in the mirror and said, you're fat, you're lazy, and you're a liar. And it's like, man, that sounds really harsh. I would never talk to myself like that. But it's like, you need to be really, really real with how you see yourself. And then from there, you can change. Because you, what is it? Like, you can't change what you don't measure. So, okay, so you're like, this is who I am. This is how I see myself. How, like, what now? And that what now is like what propels you forward into the growth mindset. So he was like, I started pasting sticky notes all around my mirror to counteract those identities. So he didn't want to be fat, lazy, and a liar. So he wrote, go on a two mile run every day. Stop lying. Go one day without lying for validation. You know, get off the couch and like go run errands or whatever. So it's like you write the actions that counteract who you don't want to be.
The empowering idea is that these things are subject to change. They're not set in stone. I think that's the most empowering thought here, that yes, that's who he described himself as and in that moment, but all those elements, all those qualities, all those perceptions of himself, they were subject to change. And he went on and changed it. Paulina, I have one last big question for you. In the conclusion to your book, Hidden Genius, you ask yourself a question that I ask all my guests. It's a question about success. And you share a story how asking yourself that question changed the trajectory of your life. Can you share that story?
Yeah. So I was on the subway going home from my work at Fortune Magazine. And I was sitting on the subway and I read this commencement speech by Anna Quinlan. And she says something like, you know, if your success looks good to the world but doesn't feel good in your heart, then it is not success at all. And I was just like, whoa. I don't know. It just like really like struck me because I was like, oh, wait a second. How do I measure success and how do I define success? And to me, at the time, for a long time, it was like steady job, health insurance, material possessions, how much money you make. Like those were markers of success. And you know, after I read this, I had been kind of thinking, like, do I want to leave my job to go work on the profile full time? And I was like, yeah, but like all those markers would kind of be gone. Like people wouldn't see me working at Fortune Magazine, all this stuff. Like the validation wouldn't be there. Maybe the money wouldn't be there at first. So I was just like, what is success? And then I realized, like, to me, success is just like feeling fulfilled. And who cares if I'm going to disappoint some random professor from my university who thought that I should be working at Fortune Magazine? I don't care. And it's like once you get to I don't care, I want to be fulfilled. I see this sometimes with my friends, like somebody who's like really artistic, but they're working a job that requires zero creativity. And I'm in my head, I'm like, I know that eventually you're going to end up doing something creative, but you define success as this very like, you know, how much money do you make type thing. And until you break that, you're not gonna, you know, you're gonna stay stuck in this awful job. So it's like when I read that, I started thinking more and I was just like, wow, well, what do all these different people, like, how do they define success? Matthew McConaughey, for him, it's a measure of five different things, including how good of, like, a father and a husband and a brother and, like, think these kinds of things. And he actually goes and, like, measures where he thinks how he's doing that year or that month. For me, it's, like, less of that and it's more of just, like, do I feel like the things that I'm working on, I'm excited about, and I feel expansive instead of just like, oh, I don't want to get out of bed. That's success to me, like a life really well lived.
I love the sound of that. A life well lived. Paulina, this was incredible. We touched on so many different big ideas, and I highly recommend your book. And I was reading your book the second time around, and I found more things that I wanted to think about. And there's so many highlights.
Thank you.
You were able to distill lessons from many people. And to me, the big idea is that, look, they achieve very different successes, very different paths. But the principles rhyme again and again. It's fascinating to see how the approaches were different, but they've done very similar things in similar ways across, and you connected the dots and you showed to the reader, to me, to our listeners today, how, look, there are things you can do and there are things that are within your control that you can include in your life and get to wherever you're going. Thank you so much for today. What a pleasure.
Thank you so much. This was a great conversation.
You were listening to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question, what it means to live a rich life beyond money. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment and follow, subscribe, rate, and share with friends and family. We rely on word of mouth to promote the show. One click for you means the world to us. Thank you. Until next time, your host, Bogumil Baranowski. The content of this podcast is for general informational purposes, and so are the opinions of the host, an employee and partner of a registered investment advisor, and guests of the show. This podcast does not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any specific security or financial instruments or provide investment advice or service. Past performance is not indicative of future results. More information on the firm is available in its Form ADV disclosure documents available on advisorinfo.sec.gov.